Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer, producer of this program. In this hour, we'll be hearing from NPR senior editor and Washington desk correspondent Ron Elving. We'll dive into his lecture, asking how deep is our commitment to democracy, in a few minutes. But first, we're going to hear a conversation between Ron Elving and WBOI news director Rebecca Green. She spoke with Elving when he visited the WBOI studios, and the two discussed the constantly changing media landscape and the decisions journalists have to make to inform the public. Enjoy!
We're so grateful to have Ron here with us today to talk a little bit about the news and politics and the way these things matter to the American people. Ron, thanks so much for being here today with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
How can local residents of Northeast Indiana or wherever best connect to the information about what's going on in D.C. at this particular period of time, where we are seeing, you know, constriction in newspapers and reduction in bureaus and reduction in space? How can we do that? And how can we best, as a public radio station, offer that to them?
Changes in technology and changes in advertising have really made it difficult for newspapers. And newspapers are no longer the overwhelming force that they had been in our public life. But the idea of journalism that came up in newspapers, that survives. And in many respects, it is more active than ever. I'm not sure it's necessarily stronger in every individual case, but there are more voices. There are more enterprises trying to provide public information about government, about political affairs, about what concerns the community and people's personal lives than there have ever been before. Lots of choices. So many choices, sometimes people may feel overwhelmed, but they can certainly turn to such sources as public radio, which tries to have a 360-degree openness to many different points of view and certainly is accessible to everyone who either has a radio or any access to the internet. There are still public sources that people can turn to, and there are so many choices on the internet that many of which are excellent sources of information, some of which have a big agenda, an axe to grind. You really have to sort of almost have a guide through the swamps and the forests of the internet. But insofar as people can spend the time, use their own independent judgment, get a lot of different points of view, there's ultimately more information out there about political life than there has ever been before.
One of the things journalists do not do well is we do not always explain how we decide, how we use those standards to say this quote, not that quote, this source is credible, that source is not. How do you explain that to people, how we do what we do?
One way to try to invite people into the difficulties of what we do is to suggest to them a situation in which they themselves have to decide who in a group of people they're listening to is giving the best representation of the facts. If they have independent information, that's great, because then they can just go by that. But if five people come back from a ball game and they're all telling a little different story about how that pitcher pitched or some particular fielder fielded, you have to then weigh the experience level of each of those people, how much they know about the sport, whether or not they were players. But we all know how to do that. And we all have done it all our lives, even as children. We were deciding which of our teachers in school we thought really had the goods and which ones we thought were sort of mailing it in or maybe didn't really know that much or needed more experience. We were making those kinds of judgments when we were very small. And we have made those judgments in high school. We have made them all through our personal and our social lives. We know how to sort out what we believe and what we don't. And if you think about that and the process that you use and the things that have worked best for you in getting to the actuality of a situation, that's pretty much what journalists try to do, and try to do quickly, because deadlines are a definitional part of what we do. We have to do it without enough time to do it as well as we would like to. We don't have the time that lawyers do preparing for court for weeks and months. So we have to make rapid differentiations. And I think people can understand that when they think about their own personal lives and their own personal experiences.
Should journalists explain more what we do and how we do it?
As a general rule, I think journalists are maybe too self-conscious and are too much concerned with themselves. Sometimes when you watch people on television, you can't help but think, you know, that some of them kind of need to get over themselves a little bit and not tell you quite so much about themselves. But I don't think we should withhold explanations for why we do things the way we do. We, for example, at NPR in recent days have spent a lot of time explaining why one of our hosts on one of our programs spent time interviewing someone who, from a white nationalist movement, someone with connections to what would be called American Nazism, if you will. And that's not the sort of thing people expect to hear on our air and shouldn't expect to hear on our air. But they should also know that we're going to reach out to everyone who's in the news and try to get their perspective. We're going to push back a little bit. We're going to ask them questions. We're not just going to give them a forum. But we do want to hear from everyone, and sometimes that's going to bother some people, and we need to explain that kind of decision and why we do it. I think we have a good story to tell.
That was WBOI's Rebecca Green speaking with NPR senior editor and Washington desk correspondent Ron Elving. And now WBOI Presents brings you his lecture, How Deep is Our Commitment to Democracy? Thank you for listening.
Good evening. Good evening, and thank you very much for that warm welcome. It has been very warm. All the time that I've been here in Fort Wayne, people have been remarkably welcoming and kind, and I appreciate that very much. It's a pleasure always to see an audience of people that, and I'm guessing many of you listen to NPR. I won't ask for a show of hands, but or show of ears. But it's great to be with people that I think are probably the sort of people we're talking to when we get on the air and when we prepare others to get on the air and when we do podcasts and everything else that we do at NPR. We are now multi-platform to the max, and that is something that that also gives us more opportunities to reach a wider and varied audience. So it's a pleasure to see you. Thank you all for being here tonight. I'm going to get into a rather serious lecture here, but I hope we can have some lighter moments, and I'm very much looking forward to taking your questions as well. We're going to talk about a subject that is obvious on the screen and is probably also obvious to most of you because you've been thinking about this to one degree or another. It's occurred to you. To what degree are we still okay with our democracy? Do we assume, as we did certainly all of us growing up, that this was simply the greatest system in the world, in the greatest possible country, in the best of all possible worlds? Not too long ago, people started talking about the idea of the end of history. Not a doomsday scenario, not that kind of end of history. And the academic who was mostly responsible for this particular phrase, the end of history, was a guy named Francis Fukuyama. And he was not talking about an awful, terrible end of the world. This was not like a sort of a Al Gore scenario where we all floated away. But it was a serious theory based on actually hopeful changes that were taking place around the world in the 1980s and 1990s. So what did he mean? Well, we saw the fall of the wall. And by the way, in those days, when we talked about the wall, we meant Berlin. And it was a good thing that it was falling down and that people were going to cross over. We saw the breakup of the USSR and the Eastern Bloc, the old Warsaw Pact. These terms sound antique to the people in the classes that I teach today at American University. Free elections in Russia and elsewhere for the first time ever, really. The end of apartheid in South Africa happened at just about the same time. Latin America reached the first point in its history where there was no military government anywhere. This has not been consistent since, of course, but at that time, no military junta was ruling a country in South America. China even seemed to be liberalizing. You remember the Tiananmen Square tragedy in the end, but nonetheless, it was symbolic of an opening society, that it was even possible that something like Tiananmen could have happened. So all of that was positive. All of that was something that you could feel good about, and it suggested, at least to this particular scholar, that we were actually witnessing the passing away of not just the Cold War, but a whole period of post-war history, that is to say, post-World War II history, and beyond that, even a greater development in human civilization, really the end of the struggle, the ideological struggle that had lasted throughout recorded history between one kind of government and another kind of government, particularly between all kinds of oppression, tyranny, autocracy, kings, other sorts of autocrats, and some expression of liberty, some expression of democracy as the final form of human government. Free markets, free elections, the final form of human political civilization. Now, it seemed a little much to say that that struggle was over just because some things were going well, but it did appear that free markets and democracy had won a lot of decisive victories. And Fukuyama would say, it's not all just stamp collecting from here on out, but expect that the final verdict is already in. The ultimate winner is clear. Then history pushed back. History said, I'm not done. There's a lot more that's going to happen, and a lot of it's not going to be good. And it happened pretty fast. Pretty fast after this halcyon moment of speculation. We saw the rise of Islamic fundamentalism. And particularly, of course, that expressed itself in our world through terrorism and wars. And, of course, the surviving autocrats got a little tougher about hanging on. When we think about lots of different regimes around the world, Korea, Iran, Iraq for a while, the Assad regime in Syria, and so on. We had the Arab Spring, which seemed very much in Fukuyama's sort of notion of where things were going, and then we had everything that came after, including ISIS, and including economic crises and ecological crises on other continents that unleashed an enormous refugee and migration crisis, which we are still suffering with today. Some of that is visible in our hemisphere, a lot more visible in the hemisphere from on the other side of the world where people from Africa are trying to get into Europe, and you have seen all of that tragic footage and video as well. And in response to that, and in response to many other developments of technological nature and political nature, we have seen the rise of populism and nationalism really across the entire world of Western civilization and that sort of conquering democracy that Fukuyama was talking about. Now, there was an American version of this all along. It wasn't all global. Every different part of the world had its own sort of progression in this regard. And in terms of the American analog, we assumed that as of the 1980s and 1990s, our political parties had settled into kind of an old relationship, like sort of an old bickering marriage in which they sort of had everything kind of worked out, but they would battle back and forth, and we sort of knew that they would both remain more or less in charge, executing certain duties within that arrangement. And this was a post-war pattern that had gotten to be pretty strong. There were a lot of things we assumed would always be the same. And they would seek middle ground. They would pass appropriations bills in a bipartisan fashion in the Senate and the House. And the competition for president would be, as we used to say, a game played between the 40-yard lines, in which the candidates who wanted to win would try to be as near the middle as possible. If you were going to be on one side, you might get a little over beyond the 50 to the 40, but you didn't want to get down to the 30 or the 20. God knows you didn't want to go into the red zone, as we say in football coverage. You didn't want to get too far down the field because that was going to isolate you. And we didn't think that you would get presidential nominations or presidential elections for that kind of candidate. And we presumed, speaking of elections, that our elections were pretty much a benign function, run by the states, with the localities, and largely staffed by volunteers. This is not a random question. How many of you have ever volunteered at a polling place? All right, good. That's a good indicator. We were our own election system. We thought of ourselves that way. It was something that we operated almost like a kind of living Jimmy Stewart movie, where we would go and we would vote and we trusted in the results of our elections because, well, the elections were ours. They were about us and we ran them. And they were worthy of our faith and trust. And we didn't really think about that too much. We knew that in other countries elections were dangerous and that people got hurt trying to vote and sometimes killed. And we thought that that was one of the great tragedies for those people who lived in those countries. And we certainly didn't worry about anything of that nature in our country, and we knew that the elections would always give us the right result. Well, then came the election of 2000. Boom. History pushes back again. We had a huge hassle over the Florida recount. Personal story, I had been not too terribly long at that time the Washington editor for NPR, and people talked about how long we should stay on the air that night. And I had had a lot of association with the California stations, and I said, you know, those people go nuts when we go off the air at midnight on the East Coast, and it's only 9 o'clock in California. Why don't we just go ahead and stay on all night? We'll go from the end of All Things Considered to midnight, and then we'll just stay on the air until the beginning of Morning Edition. And they said, okay, well, we'll try that. We'll try that one time. What are you going to say on the air? And I said, well, let's give everybody a guarantee that NPR will stay on the air until we can give you a winner. Well, 35 days later, the Supreme Court gave us a winner, and we reported on it. That was the Bush v. Gore case. It was also a split between the popular vote and the Electoral College. That had been rare in our history, but we have seen it again just in 2016. There were a lot of problems with voting tech, and people lost a lot of faith in the machinery and in the way that we counted. And since then, we've encountered something a good deal more sinister, which is the suspicion that some of the tech is not in our control. I mean, it's one thing to have a hanging chad out of a card and wonder, gee, which way should we count that? It's another thing to wonder who produced the cards and who is actually, in some sense or another, manipulating the results. I know that could have taken many different kinds of forms, and we're worried about the forms that it might take in the future, and that's a whole other discussion. But haven't we all lost a certain amount of faith that we used to have, that it was a benign institution that just happened and it was fine and we knew that the results were something we could trust? Just a little bit. And that is an insidious kind of loss. Congress actually responded to this, and in a fairly short period of time, like a year or so. I usually say that watching the House and Senate operate is like watching the glaciers race. But they actually responded pretty quickly with something called the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA. And this was meant to relieve the fears that people had, legitimate fears, about the legitimacy and efficacy of the systems that we were using. But then, boom, more history. We had the agony of 9/11. And the good side of that, and I think this was a legitimate good side of that tragedy, was that it was briefly highly uniting. Members of Congress and both parties stood on the steps of the Capitol and sang God Bless America. That was a moving scene. There were many examples of people trusting each other in that environment that we have not seen since. And it did boost confidence in our system for a period of time. But regrettably, we can't really say that it has lasted.
WBOI Presents will return after a short break. Thank you for listening to 89.1 WBOI.